is Taking Aim with
Rav Shonman
and Maya Shon, and we're so pleased to be back with all of you. This is 1 week after the U.S. election and the overwhelming election of Barack Obama, the senator from Illinois, as president of the United States, and Joseph Biden, senator from Delaware, as vice president. Today on Taking Aim, we are going to have another call-in show for your comments on the election and our reflections on the election outcome. We call the program Soft Soap and Sell Out. Reflective of what we've been reporting on Taking Aim over the past few months with our programs such as Barack Obama, Not a Dime's Worth of Difference. And we don't say this lightly. Today on Taking Aim, Ralph will reflect upon it. As you can tell from my voice, I have a very bad cold, and before I break out coughing, I'm going to turn the mic over to Ralph. And please call in 212-209-2900. We're eager to hear from you. We'd like your questions for us. Please keep your comments short and give us your questions, 212-209-2900. And next week, we'll be back with our regular programming. Meanwhile, here's Ralph Shonman on Soft Soap and Sell Out.
Thanks, Maya. Brothers and sisters, we're going to have a discussion today, and next week we're going to have an intensive program on the structure, the nature of the Obama presidency, what it represents, who guides him, who controls him, what is the real agenda. What we are going to be addressing, in essence, is the Obama team, from the Chief of Staff, Rahm Emanuel, to John Podesta, to Paul Volcker, to Lawrence Summers, to Henry Paulson, to Warren Buffett, to who they are, what they represent. In fact, Jerusalem Post, brothers and sisters, interestingly enough, in its lead story, Rahm Emanuel, the Obama's Chief of Staff, described how Rahm Emanuel had been a key figure for the Israeli government. He served as a soldier in the IDF at the time of the first Gulf War. His father, Dr. Benjamin Emanuel, was a leader of the Irgun, the terrorist apparatus that engaged in the massacre of Palestinians across Palestine, beginning with Deir Yassin, that engaged in assassination in Austria and in other countries. Interestingly enough, the Israeli publication Maariv interviewed Dr. Benjamin Emanuel about the appointment of his son, and the question they asked him was, would his son's appointment be good for Israel? Quote, obviously he's going to influence the president to be pro-Israeli. Why wouldn't he? What, is he an Arab? He's not going to clean the floors of the White House, Dr. Benjamin Emanuel. Dr. Emanuel disclosed that his son spends part of every year in Tel Aviv, that he consults with Israeli intelligence, that he is, in fact, deeply integrated and involved in the operations of the Israeli state.
That is clear because Emanuel accompanied President-elect Obama when he was a candidate to a meeting of the AIPAC, that's the AIPAC Executive Board, the Israeli lobby here in the United States, although they don't claim to be the lobby. They present themselves as a nonprofit organization, an independent nonprofit organization, but it is the Israeli lobby. And Emanuel accompanied Barack Obama to the meeting of the Executive Board, and this was just after Barack Obama had addressed the pro-Israel lobby conference last June, and that's a presentation that we have discussed at length on Taking Aim because of its support for the Zionist state. And not only did he serve in the IDF at the time of the Gulf War, he was actually serving in occupied Lebanon. At that time, the Israelis had still occupied Lebanon after the 1982 invasion, and they hadn't left yet. They stayed there for over 10 years. And Emanuel served in South Lebanon.
Emanuel has been a consistent, ardent supporter, basically, of the Likud wing of the Zionist state. Emanuel, along with 33 other Democrats, wrote to George Bush in which they accused Bush. They said, "We are deeply dismayed to hear of your criticisms of Israel for fighting acts of terror." And they attacked Bush for being insufficiently supportive of Israel's forward plans of assassinating anybody who was considered to be an opponent of the Israeli state. Emmanuel has been as well one of the most ardent advocates and supporters of the war against Iraq prior to that, to the moment when Bush and Cheney made public that they were intending to launch such a war. And when congresspersons were being groomed for the Democratic Party candidacies in various congressional seats, Rahm Emanuel organized 33 such congressional Democrats who were pro-war, pro-Iraq war. He supported not only the war in Iraq ardently and aggressively, but had been a consistent advocate and remained so for preemptive strike against Iran. There's a great deal more to say. He's the point man for NAFTA. He's the point man for the privatizations. He is somewhat to the right of Genghis Khan, this figure. There is much to say more about the team. We will get into that more next week. But even now, in response to questions, let's take some calls, brothers and sisters, and we'll amplify some of this information.
Again, 212-209-2900. Michael, our first caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I think that this is a very dangerous time with Barack Obama because it reminds me when they put Colin Powell in charge of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the war and the million or half million people that died in that war and the million in this war. How do you respond? How would you respond to people who say that this is, I mean, they're treating him like the second coming, like the Messiah, and any criticism you make is like, nobody wants to even discuss the possibility that this guy's another Bill Clinton.
Yes, well, of course, there's been a tremendous amount of excitement and there's a tremendous amount of expectation and hope that's been aroused around the populist rhetoric in which Barack Obama has indulged, arousing expectations in order to, in fact, channel the deep and abiding and profound disaffection and anger of the mass of our people against the 8 years of the Bush aggression against the peoples of the world and this decimation of our living standards and the rapine capitalist exploitation to which people have been subjected. So the task, as always, of the Democratic Party, and particularly at this moment in time, as you indicate, has been to canalize people into its ranks. But the problem, of course, is that imperialism and capitalism has no latitude for in any way meeting the expectations of the mass of our people. And the meaning of this is so brutal, so explicit, that even as Barack Obama conducted his campaign against what he called the old politics and calling for basic change and for sweeping out the old who in no way represented the interests of the population, the second that he even assumes office without power, his first step is to appoint a team of people who represent the heart of imperialist conquest and of capitalist exploitation.
And Ralph, who represent the Democratic Leadership Conference, which is the organization set up by Bill Clinton to move the Democratic Party to the right.
Well, in fact, it was explicitly designed, the Democratic Leadership Conference, to import the Republican Party politics of the right into the mainstream of the Democratic Party. That was the task of Clinton. Rahm Emanuel was a very key point man in that apparatus and in that operation, but it only begins with Rahm Emanuel.
And let's go on to our next caller. Michael? Hello, you're on the
yes.
air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Oh, Ralph and Maya, this is absolutely tilting me. I am so overwhelmed with the information. Where is Bill Maher, Charlie Rose, and Oprah Winfrey, Martha Stewart? Are they supportive of this? Are they aware? Are they not aware?
Well,
do you see any value and having a black man in office as president? Do you think there is any value that has occurred because of this taking place?
Well, let me address that concretely. Of course, with respect to Bill Maher, Bill Maher is a very ardent and explicit supporter of Israel and of the Zionist state. He's a almost racist figure when it comes to the Arab East and to Muslims and to Arabs in general. He's a liberal who has the conventional politics of Democrats and liberals, but in the question with respect to the Zionist state and the agenda of imperialism in the region, he is slightly to the right, again, as I like to say, of Genghis Khan. He calls for his favorite interviewee was Joe Biden, in advocating the fragmentation of Iraq into its ethnic and religious components, which was, in fact, the Zionist agenda since 1979. As to Charlie Rose, Rose is not even a Democrat. I mean, he's basically a bourgeois figure who is supportive of whatever the status quo is. I think the issue is not so much these pundits and spokespersons of the established corporate media. I think the question that we have to address is the expectations of the mass of our people, for whom the prospect of a black president was so much an issue of hope. But I think it's essential that we look at the basic question here, because the issue of color, if you like, of race, the identification of a figure like Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice or Barack Obama with the fate, the condition, the aspirations, the plight of the mass of African Americans in this society is a cruel deception. As Malcolm would say so often, it's not about a black face in a high place. The issue is not merely the question of race, but the question of class. That's the hidden issue. Because the issue for African Americans is that they are the most victimized, the most exploited, the most subjugated sector of the oppressed, of the working masses of our society. And there is no liberation, there is no emancipation, there is no realization of the needs, the daily survival needs of African Americans in this society without an agenda that addresses the dictatorship of capital. Race and its exploitation of the vulnerability of African Americans, of Latinos, of people, blacks and browns in this society, is an instrument of class dictatorship and class rule. And there's no liberation from this dictatorship without challenging at its root the capital, the concentration of capital in the hands of a handful of people, the institutionalization of that control, and the use of the coercive power of the state to crush all those who are exploited in a continuing and systemic and generational fashion. So Barack Obama, insofar as he integrates himself within the councils of the corporate capitalist class, becomes their mouthpiece, their spokesperson, can only be the siren song of further predation.
And Ralph, the instrument for delivering the working class to their own subjugation. Let's go on to our next caller. Again, 212-209-2900. Today on Taking Aim, we're discussing soft soap and sellout, the reflections on the election last week, 1 week ago, of Barack Obama as president-elect of the United States. Hello, you're on the air. Hello?
I think we lost that caller.
Michael, on to the next caller.
Hi.
Hello, you're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Thank you. I appreciate the commentary. Now that the president-elect says he's going to send more troops into Afghanistan, do you think more heroin is going to flow from Afghanistan and into the streets of London and New York? I'll listen.
Good question. The answer in short is absolutely and yes, because paradoxically, the main vehicle for the heroin traffic in Afghanistan were the CIA's puppets in Afghanistan, in the Northern Alliance, Gulbuddin Hekmatyar and company. The Taliban, for all their retrograde and reactionary feudal policies, were the opponents of the heroin traffic in Afghanistan. And it's the, as you indicate, the Drug Enforcement Administration, the Central Intelligence Agency, that has been the principal vehicle and marketer and organizer of the heroin and cocaine and crack traffic within the inner cities of the United States. It's a form of subjugation. It's a form of basically of demoralization of the mass
and
of our people.
Dissolution.
Let me just mention one other thing about this, since you raised the issue of Afghanistan. Democracy Now! And Amy Goodman, along with Jeremy Scahill, interviewed Barack Obama on two occasions. Barack Obama stated explicitly that he intends to leave all of the mercenaries of Blackwater, all of the privatized forces of subjugation intact and in place in Iraq. And furthermore, he intends to leave at least 100,000 U.S. troops. We're talking about, this is not ambiguous, 200,000 permanent occupiers of Iraq. So all of this talky talk about the ending of the war in Iraq and of winding it down is, of course, soft soap for the sellout. And the expansion of the war in Afghanistan is exactly the agenda that the likes of Rahm Emanuel and the Zionist apparatus of JINSA and of the American Enterprise Institute and APEC have laid out for a whole wing of the ruling class. Iraq is the little beginning. Afghanistan is the intensive continuation. Pakistan is the next target. And in fact, in the most recent days in the New York Times and in the Washington Post, what we call imperialism redux, the Obama advisors, here's a story in the New York Times, Obama advisors discussed preparations for war on Iran. The article entitled "The New Beltway Debate, What Do We Do About Iran?" outlines military action to stop Iran's so-called nuclear weapons program, and it doesn't stop there. The top Middle Eastern advisor for Barack Obama, Dennis Ross, well known for his hawkish views, as the Times says, who backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, closely associated with neocons such as Paul Wolfowitz, who worked under Wolfowitz, under Carter, and then under Reagan before becoming the chief Middle East envoy under Bush Sr. and then Clinton, and who joined the right-wing pro-Israeli think tank, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and then signed up as a foreign policy analyst for Fox News. Point man for who? For Barack Obama. What is the Barack Obama team? I'll just take a moment quickly, brother, to outline this. John Podesta, chief of staff for Clinton from 1998 to 2001, the transition project's leader. Longtime Washington insider, legal counsel for congressional committees. He is the representative, the principal lobbyist for whom? His top clients are the oil giant British Petroleum, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, the biotech firms Genentech and Amgen, the Swiss pharmaceutical companies Novartis International AG, and no less, Walmart. He has the dubious distinction of being ranked the third most powerful lobbyist in Washington, whose pipeline problems and refinery fires have created enormous regulatory and public relations issues, according to the Washingtonian. Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, is the main funder and financier and controller of John Podesta. He is the chief executive order of the Center for American Progress, set up with funding from the billionaire investor and Obama advisor Warren Buffett. We could go down the list, but you get the picture. This is the man who's going to kick out the insiders, the old politicians, who's going to make change, and every single one of the figures who is the vehicle, the administrator, the controller, the bureaucratic apparatus that will be in control of the Barack Obama administration is the same old, same old.
Hello, we're ready for our next call. You're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Yes, how you doing, Ralph and Maya? I see the Obama campaign as striking a knockout punch to what I call the collective mindset. Okay. If you can touch up on a brief history of the Joe Biden, I remember they were talking about, especially McCain was telling about how he was not experienced with his foreign policy issues and he wasn't good or whatever, and then he goes straight to the Council on Foreign Relations, and then out comes Joe Biden, the chairman. If you can explain that, what all this means. And I listen off the air.
Well, Joe Biden is chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, not the Council on Foreign Relations.
But your basic point is correct about Biden. I mean, Biden is at the heart and center of imperial policy. Biden's primary contribution to foreign policy has been to call for the breakup of regional of the region in the Middle East into ethnic and religious components.
Right. You will recall the Biden plan for Iraq was, instead of a unitary Iraq, was to have it divided up into a Kurdish, a Sunni, and a Shiite area.
Yes, and in short, to they would all be they all would be little statelets, essentially dysfunctional Bantustans without military independence of any kind, who would hand over the control of their resources to American oil companies. That's the project. That's the agenda. That's what Biden represents. Biden, by the way, is a very ardent supporter of the forward NATO expansion into the former Soviet Union. He, along with John McCain, were very central in coordinating with this Saakashvili in Georgia with the assault upon Ossetia and the agenda of imperialism in the region. So, unfortunately, when we look at this, I mean, it's mind-boggling when you actually see the personae who are heading up a Barack Obama administration and controlling it. It's Warren Buffett, it's Robert Rubin, it's Paul Volcker. These are people who are at the heart of capital. Paul Volcker is the former Fed chairman. He is one of the most influential dismantlers of any regulatory control over finance capital in the banking industry.
During the Reagan administration.
Yeah, but it goes on from there, because then you have the likes of not just of Volcker, but of Robert Reich and Robert Rubin, who represent the same. Lawrence Summers, the former Treasury Secretary, by the way, who whose contribution to our political discourse when he was at Harvard was to insist that women were not capable of doing math and science because their brains were too small. You know, I mean, translate women into blacks and you get the agenda here, brothers and sisters. This is the real mindset of this ruling class. I mean, they have contempt for the mass of our people. They are racist to the core, and they follow an agenda of capital's predation, and the population is just cannon fodder to this. I cannot emphasize enough the genocidal content of capitalist rule in our society. It has always an imperial reach, but it has a very specific implication for the fate of our people within our society as well.
Ralph, let's take, we have one more question before the station ID. Hello, you're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
How are you, Ralph and Maya?
We're doing fine.
Thanks for calling.
I'm a combat era Vietnam vet. And
yes.
Happy Veterans Day to me and all of my brothers out there in arms.
Okay, we wish you a happy Veterans Liberation Day, brother.
Yes. You know, you can't make an omelet without breaking the eggs. You know, I understand where you guys are coming from, but also the man's not even inaugurated. Can we give him a break, you know, like see what happened? And I know you're talking about the people from Clinton, but Clinton left us in the red. He left the Bush, the Bushito, Comandante Bush, with a good deal of money for this country, and Bush wiped it out within 6 months after 9/11. You know, I'm saying, you know, I understand your point, but can we just give him a little leeway and see what takes place here?
Well, I would say to you, I appreciate the sentiment here of giving Barack Obama a breather and a chance, but I would turn it around and say, how about giving us a chance? How about giving us a breather? You no sooner ceased the rhetoric, you've no sooner been elected, when you announce that your team is going to be the very vehicle of the war in Iraq, the very vehicle of the most relentless exploitation and impoverishment of the mass of our people. You sign on for all the major bailouts. It's not enough that AIG has stolen all the money it was given. Now you want to give them 50% more. It's not enough that the banks and the investment houses that have taken over $1 trillion and they've not used it to expand any kind of credit or lending. We'll go into that in some detail. Now you want to double it up. Whose agenda is that? You're talking about, just to give you a little insight here, before the election of Barack Obama, in the last days of the campaigning, when he appeared with the very president, Bill Clinton, that you're referring to, in Orlando, and they talked about the surplus. You know how that surplus was obtained, by the way? That surplus was obtained out of the hides of working people, by downsizing government, as they called it euphemistically, by ending welfare support for the most impoverished and the most poor, for dismantling public service employees and all of their protections and their wages and their health care and their pensions, for imposing NAFTA and the privatizations and the outsourcing of jobs and a mad rush to the sweatshop bottom, for basically consolidating the breaking of the trade unions that Reagan had been so effective in advancing. That's the Clinton agenda. And Clinton gets on a platform in Orlando, Florida, with Barack Obama, and in the course of his speech he says, now, Barack may be angry at me for saying this so soon prior to the election, but let me tell you who he is, how reliable and dependable he is. When this capitalist crisis occurred, Barack Obama called me up. He called up Paul Volcker. He called up Warren Buffett. He called up Henry Paulson. Now, we're talking about the very Treasury secretaries and Commerce secretaries and supervisors of this whole
crisis. We need guys like you and Maya.
What's that now?
That's why we need guys like you and Maya.
Well, I appreciate that, but let me just make the point. He called them up. And he said to them, you tell me what to do. This is Clinton speaking. He's saying, Barack called us up. And he called them up and he said, you tell me what to do, I'll do it and I'll sell it. I'll sell it. Anything more explicit than that? Volcker engineered the draconian shift in U.S. monetary policy. Long-standing commitment in U.S. liberal politics was Keynesian fiscal and monetary policies for full employment as the objective. Volcker dismantled this. He began the long, deep recession with the Federal Reserve. His shock policies for working people drove interest rates up to 20%. It absolutely devastated working-class earnings and transferred wealth on a massive basis. That's the Volcker legacy. He's the point man to whom Barack Obama turned. You tell me what to do and I'll sell it? You get the... Let's be clear about what we're facing here. There's no ambiguity about it.
And the first words out of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to Barack Obama was a warning: go slow, reach across the aisle. In other words, her first words were not, now is a time where we can put into place, we can reverse what the Bush administration did in decimating civil liberties and destroying people's economic welfare. Instead of saying that, she's saying, go slow, go slow. In other words, watch out, and please satisfy the ruling class.
Please remember this. The Obama team consists of Lawrence Summers, who I've mentioned, Timothy Geithner, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and the former Federal Reserve Chairman Paul Volcker. But the Volcker shock was not only raising interest rates to 20%. Volcker praised Reagan for breaking PATCO, the air traffic controllers, calling his action the most important factor in bringing inflation under control. Bringing inflation under control, breaking workers and trade unions in the United States, ending public sector unionism in the United States. This is the agenda. How about Richard Holbrooke, who was the main architect of the genocidal war in Yugoslavia and for the onslaught against Haiti?
Well, we're going to continue this discussion, Ralph, after this brief pause for a station identification.
And you are listening to BAI New York, BAI New York.
This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, November 11th, Tuesday, 1 week after the presidential election and the overwhelming victory of Barack Obama, the senator from Illinois, as the first African-American president of the United States. And along with Barack Obama, we have Joseph Biden, the senator from Delaware, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and a longtime hardline Zionist. So here we are today on Taking Aim, taking your calls, your comments, and most of all, your questions, 212-209-2900. Hello, you're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Hi, Maya and Ralph. How are you?
How are you doing? Thanks for calling.
Oh, great. No, thank you so much for this program. You're unbelievably informative. And while some of your information is debilitating and very saddening for me right now, I really appreciate that you're out there educating all of us. I called quite a while ago, and some of the information you've given in regard to the other callers has almost answered my question.
Yes.
But what I was wondering was, again, listening has helped me understand the fundamentals of the Obama camp. But you were saying earlier in regards to the impoverished and, you know, the less fortunate in our country, those who are being, you know, taken advantage of, that the fundamentals of our capitalist society had to change. And I was just wondering if, like I said, I understand now when you're talking about who's in charge that this might not even be possible. But some of the things that Obama ran on, such as health care and, you know, education, more money for welfare and things like that, I'm wondering if those sorts of things, if they even can happen, if those would speak to that fundamental impoverished part of our society, if that would help to lift them up, things like health care and the future of education. I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
I appreciate you're asking that question, and it's a very important question because he's aroused these expectations. He's made these rhetorical commitments, and no sooner has he done that, but he had both Biden and himself declare that the crisis of American capitalism is such that they're going to have to go slow, that people are going to have to be patient. It won't be done in 1 year. It won't be done in one term. And in fact, they won't be able to implement many of the things they had expected to do because of the capitalist crisis. They've said that explicitly. Meanwhile, the speech by Joe Biden talks about incredibly tough foreign policy actions that he and Obama are preparing. He's going to need help. He's going to need you, not financially to help him. We're going to need you to use your influence within the community, to stand with him, because it's not going to be apparent initially. It's not going to be apparent that we're right. There's going to be a lot of you who want to go, whoa, wait a minute, whoa, I don't know about this. I don't think these decisions are sound. That's not what you said you were going to do. But he says decisions were made are not going to be popular, but they are sound, because if they were popular, they would not be sound. What do you think he's talking about? This man is talking about scuttling all of those promises. This man is talking about more than that. He's talking about a major escalation of U.S. imperial armed adventures, explicitly.
Ralph, I want to point out an important article that appeared several weeks ago in the New York Times by Steve Lohr. This was October 18th, and it was called Government's Leap into Banking Has Its Perils. And the reason I point to this article is because we've heard about the $700 billion bailout, and we've heard other figures about the bailout for Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, and then there's one bailout after another, and nobody ever adds it all up. And that was done in this New York Times article, and I'll just read one paragraph from it. In theory, Lohr writes, the funds committed for everything from the bailouts of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and those of Wall Street firm Bear Stearns and the insurer American International Group to the financial rescue package approved by Congress to providing guarantees to backstop selected financial markets is a very big number indeed, an estimated $5.1 trillion. And to show just what $5.1 trillion is and that it's just not an abstract number, Lohr writes, that unnerving figure is equal to more than one-third of the yearly output of the United States economy. So when it comes to money for health care, money for education, money for any of the social needs of the United States, that money has been diverted to bail out the ruling class.
You see, over all these many years, what has every administration told us? What do the governors of every state tell us? There is no money for health care. There's no money for housing for the poor. There's no money for jobs. There's no money for libraries, for schools, for hospitals, for improving our infrastructure. There's no money. There's no money. There's $2 trillion for the war in Iraq. There's trillions of dollars for the speculators and for the bankers that are enriching themselves on a scale that's unprecedented. Here is the New York Times editorial, October 29th. Loans? Did we say we'd do loans? According to Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, consulted, by the way, by Barack Obama, the chief proponent of the big bank bailouts, flooding the banks with taxpayers' money, was supposed to get them to start lending freely again. That, in turn, was supposed to stabilize markets and prevent the downturn from being worse than otherwise it would be. It was not clear from the start exactly how Mr. Paulson would ensure things would go that way. Indeed, earlier this month, shortly after the bailout was enacted, the Times reporter Mark Landler reported that Treasury official wanted to steer the bailout billions to the banks to use that money for them to buy up other banks, not to lend credit. And lo and behold, $250 billion of bailout funds committed to the largest banks. It turns out that the recipients of this investment are not at all interested in making loans, in making credit available. It appears that Mr. Paulson is not so bothered about their reluctance. Mr. Paulson and the bailout recipients have some explaining to do. Congress should plan hearings. In a column on Saturday, the New York Times' Joe Nocera told about a conference call he listened in on between employees and executives of JPMorgan Chase. Asked about the handout of $25 billion of bailout funds and whether it would change bank lending policy, the executive says, "We're using the money to buy up bargain banks. There are great opportunities for us to grow and make money in this environment. We're using that $25 billion in that way. The money could be used as a backstop in case we need more money in the kitty." There's not a word about lending, the editorial continues, not to businesses, not to home buyers, not to car buyers, not to students, not to workers, not to consumers, not to the unemployed, just the opposite. In response to another question, the executive said, "The banks expect to tighten credit." And J.P. Morgan, the editorial continues, is not alone. The Wall Street Journal reported on Tuesday that regional bank recipients of the bailout money acknowledged that a tiny portion will be used for loans and the rest would be for acquisitions and profit. This editorial goes on. But you know, sister, it's only the little beginning. Here is the article in the New York Times on the next day, October 30th. A question for AIG. Where'd the cash go? American International Group running through $103 billion in emergency lending given to them by the Federal Reserve. Where'd it go? You don't just suddenly lose $120 billion overnight, said Don Vickrey of Gradient Analytics, an independent securities research firm in Scottsdale, Arizona. AIG, accumulating tens of billions of dollars of losses when it came close to collapse, receiving first $85 billion in a line of credit by the Fed and then supplemented by a $38 billion lending facility, all of it's gone, into pockets. Quiet windfall for the banks, says the Washington Post on November 10th. With attention on the bailout, the Treasury made a secret change to tax policy. The financial world is fixated on Capitol Hill. As Congress battled over the Bush administration's request for a $700 billion bailout of the banking industry. But corporate tax lawyers quickly realized the enormous implications of a document administrative officials had just given American banks, a windfall of more than $140 billion. The sweeping change to decades of tax policy escaped the notice of the lawmakers. They remained consumed with the bailout bill. When they found out, some legislators were furious. Congressional staff members have concluded that the notice is illegal. Did the Treasury Department have the authority to do this? No. Every tax expert would agree. The article continues in the Washington Post. The answer is no. You know what they're talking about? They secretly changed Section 382 of the tax code, a provision that limits tax shelters from arising in corporate mergers. Until the financial meltdown, opponents thought it would be impossible to revamp this section because it would look like a corporate giveaway. You know what they've done? Under the cover of the bailout, they've allowed these corporations to buy companies that are in deficit, that have losses for pennies, and then to invoke those losses for getting a complete exemption from not only paying any taxes, but they are able to get refunds on the basis of the losses of the company they bought for pennies. It's outright theft. It comes to hundreds of billions of dollars in the long term, brothers and sisters. A quiet windfall for the U.S. banks. This is the rapine, capitalist assault on working people in the very guise of the bailout. What does Barack Obama and his team advocate? Double it up. Increase the bailout for the banks. Increase the bailout for AIG. Extend the bailout to General Motors and Chrysler. But what about the promises for health care? What about the promises for help for the unemployed? What about the promises for people who are losing their homes for default? We won't be able to get it done soon. In the midst of this crisis, there won't be any money for it, says Barack Obama in his very acceptance speech on the day of his election, brothers and sisters. Got the picture?
Thank you for calling, and the number to call is 212-209-2900. Today we're having a special call-in show, Reflections on the Election, and it's soft soap.
And sellout.
Sellout. You're on the air with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
Yes, hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I hope your cough gets better. I hope mine does too.
I hope so too.
But anyway, I wanted to personally say that I'm relieved that Rahm Emanuel has been appointed as chief of staff, because I know a key concern in the Jewish community was about how that they were afraid that Obama would, sell Israel up the river. Apparently, he's not going to do that. And I know that according to you in particular and BAI in general, Israel can do no right, and the Palestinians who bomb buses of women and children can do no wrong. But that is not, the perception of a lot of people. And I am thankful that, that a pro-Israeli person like Rahm Emanuel is appointed chief of staff.
Well, thank you for calling. I think
it's important that you make that comment, brother, because, you see, you're quite right. He's a pro-Israeli person, but he's not merely that. He has been identified in FBI documents as a representative of the Mossad. That has been reported in a number of places, and so, in fact, he has a long association with the intelligence services of another state. And what is that about? That's about an agenda that has to do not merely with the subjugation of the Palestinian people and their dispossession. That has to do with a forward agenda for the entire Arab East, for the Central Asian republics. The Washington Times had cited the data, and the Times of London had cited the data of the association of Rahm Emanuel with the intelligence services of the Israeli state, but not merely with respect to the forward policies of Barack Obama, but with the prior policies of engineering an attack on Iraq, with the mandate of funding 33 candidates to run as Democrats for Congress who were pro-war. This is prior to Bush declaring war in Iraq, with the project of preparing in Congress for support for a preemptive attack on Iran. Isn't it interesting that Barack Obama, who was so intimately involved with Rahm Emanuel and with this whole Chicago apparatus — this is, by the way, the Chicago Stock Exchange, by the way, in which huge funding was provided — Barack Obama was calling for a preemptive strike on Iran when? In 2004. Why and how was he groomed as the candidate to represent the interests of whom? The dispossessed masses of the United States, oppressed African Americans, the working people of the United States who have such a hard time? Who is the funder of Barack Obama? Who are the political mentors of Barack Obama? What is the team of Barack Obama today? Does he represent the people who voted him in, or does he represent the Mossad and the Israeli state, of which Rahm Emanuel is the point man?
I'd like to make one brief comment to our listener, and that we don't associate your religious affiliation, whether it's Jewish or non-Jewish, with that of the imperial designs or the colonial designs, which are political movements, and that is the Zionist movement. Our goal is always the democratic aspirations of people throughout the world. And we would hope that our WBAI listeners share the striving for democracy, striving for equality, striving for the fulfillment of all our needs, which means no exploitation of peoples by another. So, and I would recommend that our current caller read The Hidden History of Zionism by Ralph Schoenman, which we've made available free on the Internet, or you can get it as in the book form. And it's available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and avail yourself of some of the history of what is now the State of Israel, that is the Zionist Project, and the coordination of this retrograde right-wing movement of the Zionist movement with the worst of the exploiters and the dispossessors of Jews as people of the Jewish religion, and also the total denigration and the move to destroy the Palestinian people as a people, wipe them off the face of the earth. So we'd like to go on to our next caller. Hello, you're on the air. 212-209-2900 is the phone number to call to reach Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. We're taking calls today about...
Hello.
Hello. You're on the air.
I just want to ask a question.
Please.
The FDR once said, the worst thing about fear is fear itself. And right now we're in a situation where we got to give Obama, Mr. Obama, or President-elect Obama, the opportunity, since he is going to be, it was a historical event that he got elected. But we have to understand that he is in a microscope, in a bubble, and all of his actions will be watched by the whole world. Just like the whole world was happy about his election, he is going to have to do the right thing for the majority of the people. And have that faith that he will. We just have to give him the benefit of the doubt. We got to give him the opportunity to do everything he mentioned in his campaign.
Well, I would ask you the following question. When Barack Obama informs us that he plans to maintain as the Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, and Robert Gates, of course, is the architect of George Bush's foreign policy, and Robert Gates gives a speech on the 30th of October at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, in which he expands Bush's doctrine of preemptive war to include preemptive nuclear strikes. And he raises the specter of the necessity to undertake preemptive nuclear strikes across the board in the United States, extended in ominous parallels between the world situation today and that which prevailed at the founding of the Carnegie Institute in 1910, 4 years before the outbreak of World War I. This is what he said. Wall Street was passing through a panic in 1910 and 1911 and facing a credit crisis. The United States had recently put down an insurgency in the Philippines at a cost of 4,200 lives. He doesn't mention 2 million Filipino lives. Comparable to today's U.S. death toll in Iraq, Europe was arming itself to the teeth and forming a series of alliances whose implications were obvious to anyone who cared to look. And Gates says the following, the pacifist illusions of the day. In fact, the expectations of working people for an alternative policy were deadly. They could not be indulged in. And Gates, moreover, was supporting the brutal suppression in this speech of the 1892 Homestead Strike. In August of 1913, he quotes Carnegie as saying, "The only measure required today for the maintenance of world peace is an agreement between three or four of the leading civilized powers," and Gates points out that this was an illusion. And turning to U.S. nuclear policy, Gates concludes from this review of U.S. imperial history, "As long as others have nuclear weapons, we must maintain these weapons ourselves. We must prepare to go on the offensive. Fear about the spread of nuclear weapons cannot be restricted to merely potential adversaries. We must prepare to take on rogue states, North Korea and Iran, Russia and China. We must prepare for non-state opponents." Gates says the United States must be able to threaten a nuclear holocaust against any who challenge the U.S. This is a full-throated agenda, expanding upon the Bush doctrine of preemptive war. This is a speech on October 28th at the Carnegie Endowment, reported on October 30th. And what does Barack Obama say? He is giving serious consideration to maintaining Robert Gates as his Secretary of Defense. Give him a chance. Give him time. He ain't giving us any chance, and he isn't giving us a moment to breathe. He's laying out an agenda with all of these people of oppression, of imperial war, of further bailouts for the financial kleptocracy, and that means one thing, more misery, more unemployment, more deprivation, and more oppression within our own society. You need a black face in a high place to carry that off in a period of extreme crisis. And they understand, this ruling class, that they have a limited time to carry out what they plan to do. And they need that latitude that the illusion and expectations of Barack Obama will provide them. We'll give him every chance to prove himself a resistor to this agenda. But what is the evidence out of his own mouth? Who are the people who he is calling forth to implement his policies? What is his message to the mass of our people with their expectations and their hopes? It's prepare yourselves for more of the same.
We don't have any more time for questions today. Next week, we're going to be returning to our regular programming. And before we close up the show, Ralph has one brief comment.
Yes, brothers and sisters, I would urge all of you to take a look at the column in today's New York Times by Bob Herbert, who has been an ardent supporter of Barack Obama, person who has had every expectation as a black journalist of liberal persuasion, who has been full of expectation and hope of the candidacy of Barack Obama. And he has been taking the measure of the recent days, and he writes the following. It's an extraordinary article given Bob Herbert's politics. It's called Beyond the Fat Cats. The most important thing the Democrats and President-elect Obama can do with regard to this economy is to attempt to bring back a sense of equity and fairness. The fat cats who place this entire economy at rest with their greed and their manic irresponsibility are laying claim to every last dime in the national treasury. Meanwhile, we're nowhere close to any economic recovery program that's going to help people who are hurting the most. Back in September, with the credit markets frozen and the stock markets panicking, the Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson was telling anyone who had listened that $600 billion had to be passed with lightning speed. No time to look closely, no time for dissent. The package was modified hurriedly. Now we learn that while all eyes were focused on this enormous new burden for taxpayers, Mr. Paulson's department was engineering, separate and apart from the bailout, what the Washington Post called a quiet windfall for U.S. banks. And this article goes on. It talks about the impoverishment of the poor. He says, we find trillions of dollars for foolish wars and for high, self-righteous high roads who wreck their companies and our economy. What about the working poor? What about the young who are being clobbered in this downturn, battered so badly they're all but destitute? There's no way to help them? This article continues in passion, and he said, let's try investing in America and its people for a change instead of just continuing to hurl billions of dollars into an endless abyss. He says, let's get some help to families who are suffering from a housing crisis, people trembling and heartbroken in the dark shadow of foreclosure. This is a clarion call to all of those who have illusions about Barack Obama and the capitalist system. Beyond the Fat Cats, New York Times, November 11th, today's date, by Bob Herbert, brothers and sisters.
And to rehear our show, or to let your friends and colleagues know about it, they can go to the WBAI archive, or they can go visit our website, our program archive, at www.takingaimradio.com. This has been Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, Taking Aim, and we'll be with you again next week.
Ah, Mr. Stay, you came so late in.